Okay, 2 Kings 4. Let's read verses 1 through 7. New American Standard says, "Now a certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elisha, 'Your servant, my husband, is dead. And you know that your servant feared the Lord. And the creditor has come to take my two children to be his slaves.' Elisha said to her, 'What shall I do for you? Tell me, what do you have in the house?' And she said, 'Your maidservant has nothing in the house except a jar of oil.' Then he said, 'Go borrow vessels at large for yourself from all your neighbors, even empty vessels, do not get a few. And you shall go in and shut the door behind you and your sons, and you shall pour out into all these vessels, and you shall set aside what is full.' So she went from him and shut the door behind her and her sons, and they were bringing the vessels to her, and she poured. It came about when the vessels were full that she said to her son, 'Bring me another vessel.' And he said to her, 'There is not one vessel more.' And the oil stopped. Then she came and told the man of God. And he said, 'Go sell the oil and pay your debt. You and your sons can live on the rest.'" So one of the wives of the sons of the prophets, when we're trying to put together some idea about who the sons of the prophets were, this tells us that they were married and had families. They weren't taking a vow of celibacy in becoming one of the sons of the prophets. But a wife of one of the sons of the prophets cries out to Elisha. Her husband is dead. She said, "You know how he served the Lord. You know how he feared the Lord. And the creditor has come to take my two sons." Apparently he was in debt. And when that happened, if the debt wasn't paid, you could take the children to be as slaves to work off that debt. Now, there was provisions to keep from this from being abused. What was to happen in a situation like this if you needed to work to pay off a debt as a Hebrew? What was to happen? What was to happen? How long did you have to serve in that position?
7 years.
Okay, 6 years, seventh year, you were set free. And you see that in Exodus 21. So 6 years. And I know some people say that sounds terrible. And in this case, with taking the children because of what the father owed, in a way that is bad, but it was a step up from imprisonment, which was not mentioned in the Old Testament law of Moses. And so he owed money, and the creditor has come to take my two children. And Elisha says, "Well, what should I do?" And he says, "Do you have anything in your house?" Elisha said to her, and she said, "Well, I have a jar of oil." And that should bring to our mind what happened to Elijah in 1 Kings 17, verses 8 through 16. As the woman said, "I only have a little flour and a little oil in a jar, and I was going to make a cake for myself and my son, and we're going to eat it, and we're going to die. It's all we have to eat." And God said, "If you trust me enough to make a bread cake for Elisha, the oil never run out, the flour will never run out, as long as this famine rests." So here you have the same kind of thing. She has nothing but a jar of oil. And he says, "Go borrow vessels, borrow as many as you can from your neighbor." And when she borrowed them, he says, "Close the door and you start pouring out into these vessels." And the sons would apparently bring her one vessel after another. And she said, bring me another vessel. And they said, we filled up every one we had. We're not told exactly how many vessels she had, but said, we have filled up all the vessels. And when that was said, the oil stopped. And they told Elisha, and Elisha said, you sell the oil, pay off those debts, and then live on the rest. I don't know how much oil went for in those days, but it seems to have bought, it seems to have been sold at a pretty decent price that she could pay off the debts and live on the rest.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know.
It does.
And she may have borrowed, you know, a lot of vessels. They may have been big vessels. And but it may have been the rest of her life. But we're just not told all of the details. But we are. What do we do with what we're told? What does this tell us about God? What does this tell us? What is being communicated in this situation?
Tiffany? One thing that comes to my mind is that he takes care of the needs of his people.
Okay. He takes care of the needs of his people. Yes, he definitely does in this situation, just as he did with Elijah in 1 Kings 17, in that a case that we've already mentioned. Now, what happened? Do you remember the situation? Let's say you were a poor Israelite. Let's say the creditor had come to him, this man, while he was still alive, and said, listen, you owe me money. You're going to have to work off this debt, and you're going to have to become my slave till you work off this debt. What options did that person have? The person that was in debt. He goes and works in slavery, but what could happen? What could happen that was good?
The year of Jubilee.
What's that?
The year of Jubilee.
The year of Jubilee, yes. In that chapter about the year of Jubilee, Lloyd, in Leviticus 25, Leviticus 25. This talks about several things that are connected with this chapter. In Leviticus 25, let's look in verse 39. If a countryman of yours becomes so poor with regard to you, that he sells himself to you. He's so poor, he sells himself to you. You shall not subject him to a slave service. He will be with you as a hired man, as if he were a sojourner. He shall serve with you until the year of Jubilee. Then he shall go out from you. But the text also mentions a possibility that a near kinsman could redeem him. He could pay the price and rescue him out of slavery. So Leviticus 25 mentions this situation of the man becoming poor. It is in the context of Jubilee, but what I was particularly focusing on is this idea of a kinsman redeemer who assumes responsibility for his relative, and he pays his debt to release him from the burden. In a certain sense, in this passage, God is viewed as fulfilling that role. God is viewed as fulfilling the role of a kinsman redeemer. Here, one of his, a widow now, who has orphans. They are in need. They have no one to redeem them, no one to pay off their bill. And God is fulfilling that role in this particular passage. Tiffany mentioned God cares for his own, and particularly those who are the weakest and most vulnerable. Listen to Deuteronomy 10 and verse 18. He executes justice for the orphan and the widow, shows his love for the alien, giving him food and clothing. In Deuteronomy 10:18, he executes justice for the orphan and the widow and shows his love for the alien by giving him food and clothing. So God is acting as a kinsman redeemer, and God is showing his love here for the orphan and the widow by giving them food and clothing, by giving them the ability to live. But this is a good passage, along with 1 Kings 17. When we doubt God's ability to provide, when we question whether he can meet our needs, these passages are good to go to. And if we get further enough along today, we also want to ask the question, how do these things remind us of the miracles of Jesus? And they do remind us, certainly, of his miracles. Okay, verses 8 through 17. Tim, would you want to read that, 8 through 17?
Now it happened one day that Elisha went to Shunem, where there was a notable woman, and she persuaded him to eat some food. So it was, as often as he passed by, he would turn in there, eat some food. And she said to her husband, "Look now, I know that this is a holy man of God who passes by us regularly. Please let us make a small upper room on the wall, and let us put a bed for him there, and a table and a chair and a lampstand. So it will be, whenever he comes to us, he can turn in there." And it happened one day that he came there, and he turned into the upper room and lay down there. And he said to Gehazi, his servant, "Call this Shunammite woman." When he had called her, she stood before him. And he said to him, "Say now to her, 'Look, you have been concerned for us with all this care. What can I do for you? Do you want me to speak on your behalf to the king or to the commander of the army?' She answered, 'I dwell among my own people.' So he said to her, 'What then is to be done for her?' And Gehazi answered, 'Actually, she has no son, and her husband is old.' So he said, 'Call her.' When he had called her, she stood in the doorway. Then he said, 'About this time next year, you shall embrace a son.' And she said, 'No, my lord, man of God, do not lie to your maidservant.' But the woman conceived and bore a son when the appointed time had come, of which Elisha had told her. And the
Go ahead.
And the child grew. Now.
Oh yeah, it is. Yeah, I thought maybe you didn't finish 17. We'll stop at 17. Okay. I know you're on a roll. Hard to stop you, but we'll try to go ahead and stop right there. But Elisha goes to Shunem, and at Shunem in verse 8, and tell me how this is translated in your version. It said that there was a prominent woman. Prominent woman. What do some of your other translations have, Bob? Well-to-do woman. Some of them have that she was wealthy, indicate something about her wealth. Sharon? Notable woman. It's hard to know in what way this is used, but some way she is a woman of some means, or a woman of some, she's well-known, and she persuades Elisha to eat food with her. Now, the way the text goes, and I don't know if she recognized from point one that he was a prophet of God. I don't know, or if I, or maybe she did perceive it, and she only mentions it to her husband after a couple of times, and they get to talk to him. But it's difficult to say. And she gets him to come in and to eat with her. And as they eat together, she said to her husband, "This is a holy man of God. Let's build a little chamber for him when he comes through this way, that he may rest." And he does it. And this is an interesting story. And I wish we would know kind of what that house looked like and that upper chamber looked like. But they furnish him with the necessary furniture for the place. There is a bed, a table, a chair, and a lampstand. I almost hate to mention this because I don't want to get too far afield with this. But what one writer was emphasizing in things like the lampstand, there are some things in this room that were in the tabernacle and the temple, and point out God's presence is with Elisha. I don't know how much can be made of that. I know it's true, God's presence is with him, but I don't know how much to tie all of this with the tabernacle. Well, he apparently comes by Shunem quite a bit. As he comes by Shunem, he'll stop in here and he'll rest a while. He'll eat a while and rest a while. That's a good plan. And but he says, "Call the Shunammite." And Elisha says, "Should I speak to the king for you?" He goes through Gehazi. He says, "Should I speak to the king for you? Should I speak to one of the military commanders?" In other words, do I need to speak to someone like that to show you favor or to show you kindness? And she says, "No, I'm content among my own people." One of the things that's interesting about that, very interesting to me, I can't ever picture Elijah asking someone, "Do you want me to speak to the king about you?" Or a military commander. Because they would have been against Elijah. They would have been against him. Not that he wasn't willing to help people, but they would have been so against him. Elisha preaches the same kind of message, and yet he doesn't seem to be alienated from these people the way that Elijah did. Maybe it's because Jehoram is not as evil as his father was. But anyway, she said, "No, I'm happy among my own people." And Gehazi says, "Well," he says, I've got an idea." After she leaves, says, "Her husband's an old man and they don't have any children." And he said, "Call her." And she's in the doorway. And he says, "At this season next year, you're going to have a son." And she says, "Oh, don't deceive me." Apparently, this is almost too good to believe it's true for this woman. I mean, after her husband passes away, she's going to be in the same kind of position maybe that the widow was in the previous account. But you know something that's very interesting? In Ruth 4, this is not mentioned in Leviticus 25, but Ruth 4 shows us part of the responsibilities of the kinsman redeemer. Part of the responsibilities of a kinsman redeemer were to provide an heir. And so God, again, may be acting in this case as kinsman redeemer, not only rescuing a poor family from slavery, but also providing an heir in this particular point. And she begged, "Don't get my hopes up. Don't get my hopes up." And the Bible says the woman conceived and bore a son that next year, as Elisha had said to her. Now, this is not used right here, but we saw this over and over in 1 Kings, and we've seen it a little bit in 2 Kings. It could say, as Elijah had said to her, according to the word of the Lord. Because we know Elisha cannot provide her with conception and a child. It is only God who can do that. So obviously this was God's work, and God is fulfilling this particular plan. The woman conceived and bore a son the next year as Elisha had said. Now, I know you're going to know this. You read this story. Who does it remind you of? Okay, particularly Abraham in Genesis 18. And the angel appeared. And the angel said, next year, Sarah, your wife, will have a son. At the time, Abraham is 99. Sarah is about 90. And the Lord says, at this time next year, I will provide you a son. And so just as God provided Abraham and Sarah with a child well beyond the time they could have expected it, he provides this couple. One thing that shows us, in spite of Israel's sin and Israel's weakness, God is still the God of Abraham. And the promises to Abraham are still alive and well. Now that's the first thing that comes to our mind, Abraham and Sarah. But there are a couple of other instances of couples that were unable to have children who did have children, and who would some of those be?
Elizabeth.
What's that?
Elizabeth.
Elizabeth did in the New Testament in Luke 1. We see that with Zacharias and Elizabeth. Hannah in 1 Samuel 1, as she was unable to have children and she has Samuel. There's one more that I'm particularly thinking of.
Manoah.
Yes, Manoah, Judges 13. And who was Manoah, Micah?
Father of Samson.
Okay, father of Samson. Now, you might say, why aren't we mentioning the mother's name? Some of you may hit me with that, particularly you women. But we're not given her name in Scripture. We're just given the father's name in this particular case. So that's why we're so male chauvinist on this point. So, Manoah. But I think, you remember the statement in the New Testament, Hebrews 13, 1 and 2? Be not forgetful to practice hospitality one with another. Let me get the exact statement. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers. For by this, some have entertained angels without knowing it. Now, that literally happened, didn't it, with Abraham and Lot in Genesis 18. That is the situation in Genesis 18. Three visitors come to Abraham in the heat of the day, and they're angels. And then two visitors come to Lot, or two visitors are in the square, and Lot takes them in their house. Literally, they entertain angels without knowing it. But I also think beyond the literal application of that, there is a principle that's being taught that often in showing hospitality, the one who benefits most is not the person who is given the hospitality, but the one who is practicing the hospitality. Here, this woman who has no heir takes care of Elisha the prophet, and look at how she is provided for. Hey, this is really, really a remarkable thing. Also, there is the statement that Jesus makes in Matthew 10. In Matthew 10 and verse 41. Matthew 10, verse 41. He who receives a prophet in the name of a prophet shall receive a prophet's reward. And she's receiving a prophet in the name of a prophet, and she receives a great reward that God is providing her with a child. But
that is not the end of the story. 18 through 28, Lloyd, if you'll read that. Or excuse me,
Can
Tiffany.
I make a comment before you go on?
Yes, absolutely.
But what first made me think of Abraham when we were reading this is when she said, "Behold, now I know that he is a holy man." And when God was talking, well, the angel came down and told Abraham, "Do not hurt the boy. Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you respect God and you obey him."
Yes, good. Genesis
so that's
22.
Like, I don't know what that says, because this is God looking down on man, and this is a man or a woman identifying a holy person. But I just thought that was some neat imagery, which does not really fit the picture you're painting. But
Well, it just shows us some ties in vocabulary as well. In heaven's recognition, even, that Abraham is righteous in Genesis 22. Or here, Elisha is being recognized by another woman. And, but yes, thank you. Anybody else like that? I didn't actually mean to overlook that. Go ahead, Lloyd.
18 to 20. Well, I was going to say, I do find it interesting that this woman is rich. And so it would be like, what do you give the person who has everything? But God can always find something for it.
That's right.
So
that's right.
Pretty interesting.
That's a good way to say it.
18 to 28?
Yes.
When the child was grown, the day came that he went out to his father, to the reapers. He said to his father, "My head, my head." And he said to his servant, "Carry him to his mother." When he had taken him and brought him to his mother, he sat on her lap until noon and then died. She went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God. She went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God and shut the door behind him and went out. Then she called to her husband and said, "Please send me one of the servants and one of the donkeys, that I may run to the man of God and return." He said, "Why will you go to him today? It is neither new moon nor Sabbath." And she said, "It will be well." Then she saddled the donkey and said to her servant, "Drive and go forward. Do not slow down the pace for me unless I tell you." So she went and came to the man of God to Mount Carmel. When the man of God saw her at a distance, he said to Gehazi, his servant, "Behold, there is the Shunammite. Please run now to meet her and say to her, 'Is it well with you? Is it well with your husband? Is it well with the child?'" And she answered, "It is well." When she came to the man of God to the hill, she caught hold of his feet, and Gehazi came near to push her away. But the man of God said, "Let her alone, for her soul was troubled within her. And the Lord has hidden it from me, and he has not told me." Oh, I'm sorry. Then she said, "Did I ask for a son from my Lord? Did I not say, 'Do not deceive me?'"
Okay. That's where my Bible draws the paragraph line. Some do other places in verse 28, but that's about as good a place to stop. Again, we're trying to kind of, as we're reading the story, I'm kind of retelling it just to kind of get it in front of us, kind of get a feel for the account. But so we've seen the child promised and the child born in verses 8 through 17. He has grown up in verse 18. How many years have passed? We're not told exactly, but it still seems like he is a young boy. And he is going out one day to visit his father in the field. His father is working with the reapers. And he says, "My head, my head," whether it be a sunstroke. I saw some commentaries are trying to argue about what kind of disease he had or illness. We just can't figure it out from what happened here. But he says, "My head, my head." And he, like a good father, sends him back to his mom. He sends him to his mother. He says, he takes one of the servants, you carry him, you go back to his mom. And he gets worse there on his mother's lap until he dies at noon. And she instantly goes up
and lays him on Elisha's bed, lays him on the bed of the man of God. And she, in the meantime, closes the door. She sends her husband, says, "Listen, I need a servant and a donkey." And her husband is surprised, says, "I need a servant and a donkey, and I'm going to go and visit the man of God, and I'm going to come back." Father doesn't ask about the son specifically, but he says, "Why are you going to him today? It's not the new moon nor the Sabbath." Now, what is that? Couple things that may tell us. What does it tell us about the new moon and Sabbath?
Are they celebratory times?
Okay, celebratory times, they are to some degree, and maybe also times to inquire of prophets. Maybe that was more common in that time. You know, because why are you sending to him today? It's not the new moon. It's not the Sabbath. And so it may be that the prophets were particularly inquired during that time. And I don't know if this is valid or not. And I don't mean to read things into the text that absolutely aren't there. But it does seem like she was the one more deeply concerned about inquiring of God and the prophet of God than her husband. Maybe she knew her husband would not share this concern. Maybe she didn't need to attract all the attention to it and be distracted. She is on a focused mission to get to Elisha, and when her husband, and she says, and all she says to this is, "It is well." Now, in Hebrew, that's one word, and it's the word shalom, peace. And this word's going to play a big part in the story. Well, she rides that donkey to Mount Carmel. Seems like something happened in 1 and 2 Kings on Mount Carmel. Tim?
Are you saying that verse 23, that's shalom?
Yes. Okay. It is the word shalom. And she saddled a donkey, and she told the servant, "You don't slow down until I tell you to." Because she's breaking the speed limit. I don't know what the donkey speed limit was, but she's breaking the speed limit to get to the prophet of God. And when you're at Mount Carmel, Elisha notices her coming and says, "There is the Shunammite," and says, "Go ask her what she needs." And so Gehazi runs over to her and says, "Is it well with you? Is it well with your husband? Is it well with the child?" And she says in verse 26, "It is well." That's the same word, peace, shalom. Same word she used in verse 23. She said to her husband, "Peace." And when Gehazi asked all these specific questions, including, "How is it with the child?" She says, "Peace." Well, obviously, she is focused to try to get to Elisha. And when she gets to Elisha, she falls at his feet, and Gehazi comes to push her away. And Elisha says, "No, don't trouble her, because her spirit is disturbed within her, and the Lord has hidden from me what the problem is." Sometimes the Lord will reveal things to Elisha that he wasn't present to see. We'll see that when we get to 2 Kings 5 with Gehazi. But in this case, he hasn't revealed it to her, to Elisha. And some have pointed out that Gehazi here is kind of in the role that the disciples were in Matthew 19 when the little children are brought to Jesus. And they're trying to say, you know, they're rebuking the children. And he is about to
push the lady away, and Elisha says no. But when she speaks, it removes all doubt as to what the problem is. The problem is that something's happened with a child. And it says, did I ask you for a son? Did I say, do not deceive me? I'm sure she thinks at this moment that in a certain sense, to have known the joy of having a child and to have experienced this devastating loss at this point was worse than not ever having one at all. I'm not trying to debate that and your feelings on that if you've been through that experience. I'm saying that's obviously what she is feeling and thinking at this moment. She's thinking, this is so painful. And she said, this is not something I asked for. She's not saying in that she's not thankful. What she is saying is this was too great for her to ask for. And now she's experienced this devastation. Let's pick up at 29. Then he said to Gehazi, gird up your loins and take my staff in your hand and go your way. If you meet any man, do not salute him. If anyone salutes you, do not answer him and lay my staff on the lad's face. The mother of the lad said, as the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you. Now I ask you to think about where have we seen that before? And he arose and followed her. Then Gehazi passed on before them and laid the staff on the lad's face, but there was neither sound nor response. So he returned to meet him and told him, the lad has not awakened. When Elisha came into the house, behold, the lad was dead and lay on his bed. So he entered and shut the door behind them both and prayed to the Lord. And he went up and lay on the child and put his mouth on his mouth and his eyes on his eyes and his hands on his hands. And he stretched himself on him, and the flesh of the child became warm. Then he returned and walked in the house once back and forth and went up and stretched himself on him. And the lad sneezed seven times, and the lad opened his eyes. Then he called Gehazi and said, call this Shunammite. So he called her, and when she came to him, he said, take up your son. And so she went in and fell at his feet and bowed herself to the ground, and she took up her son and went out. Now, a couple of things. Gird up your loins. Take your staff. If somebody salutes you, don't stop to salute them. Do not answer. If someone salutes you, don't answer them, and don't stop to salute anyone. Jesus gave that same statement. He told that same thing to the 70 when he sent them out on the limited commission, or sent them out in Luke 10, verse 4. The same urgency facing Gehazi as he goes to the Shunammite's house is the same urgency Jesus sent out the disciples with, the 70, to preach the message of the kingdom of God. But he's hoping that the woman goes with Gehazi. Gehazi takes his staff. He's going to eventually lay it on the dead child. And he tries to send the woman ahead. And she says, as the Lord lives and as you live, I am not leaving you. Where have we seen that before?
Ruth and Naomi for one.
Well, Ruth and Naomi, you do see that kind of thing, yes.
Elisha
said that to Elijah more recently. But you do find other examples of that, as Joy points out. But just recently, that's what Elisha said to Elijah. And maybe this reminds him of his commitment to Elijah. And so, you know, he understands. But Gehazi lays his staff on the child, and there is no sound. There's no response. That's kind of like praying to Baal. No sound, no response. There's no answer here. But Elisha comes, he shuts the door, he prays to the Lord, he stretches himself out on the child. Why does he do that? I'm not sure,
We saw Elijah do the same thing in 1 Kings 17. But the child comes to life and he presents the Shunammite alive. Take up your son. And he went in and he fell at his feet. She fell at his feet, excuse me, and bowed to the ground. Now, what comments do you have on this? A couple more things I've got a thought about. But what do you see, Isaiah?
This also kind of reminds me of when the apostles can't cast out the demon themselves.
Yes.
Jesus does. And so you may have been coming to that, but that really stood out to me.
Yeah. The apostles said, why could we not cast it out? This kind doesn't go out except by a prayer. Some manuscripts have fasting and prayer. It's in Mark 9 and it's in Matthew 17.
Wasn't there a man with leprosy or a man with leprosy and he kept basically harassing Jesus and they were saying, be quiet, be quiet.
I think it's a blind man.
Oh, blind man. Yeah. I know I had it.
Yeah.
It's tough.
Yes, and so that's similar too in that way. Tiffany?
I was thinking, you mentioned that the all as well is actually the word shalom. I had a friend who went to Jerusalem, got to do one of those things over there, and she came back talking about how when we think of shalom, we think of peace, but that's actually kind of minimizing that word a little bit. I was trying to find her post, and I couldn't, but I found something that I think resonates, because the true biblical shalom means an inward sense of completeness or wholeness. Although it can also be described as the absence of war or peace, a majority of biblical references refer to an inner completeness and tranquility. So when I think about this with the story, kind of even like Lloyd was saying, she had all she wanted. And this man of God introduced this something to her. And now she's not complete, she's not whole because it's missing.
Yes.
And she's looking back.
As the story ends, she does have it. And so that's the thing is, and thank you, because I forgot to say that. She says peace in verse 23, but there is no peace. She says peace in verse 26, but there's not peace. And even though the word's not repeated at the end of the story, I think we're to see right now, there is peace. Shalom. And like you said, because she has lost it, but now it's been restored. And so it is completeness, wholeness, as Tiffany said, all of it summed up here. Tim?
So does she say that in verse 23 and 26 because she trusts in Elijah and God, or Elisha and God? Or because it's not what she says to Elisha? And
no.
So I think
that she says it there just to get out of the situation. Okay, let me give you a parallel.
Oh, it's just kind of like how
you're running to somebody to tell them your problems, and somebody says, how is everything? But you're fine. Have you ever done that? Well, obviously it's not fine. That's why you're looking for somebody else that you're supposed to talk to tell them your problem. Yeah. I think it's the same kind of circumstance that she is saying that, but I do think the word becomes ironic because ultimately, the story does end with that. Even though the word's not mentioned, I think the idea is present. Joy?
I guess I always thought in the past that her faith was so strong because she knew Elisha was a man of God.
Uh-huh.
And she didn't even want to bother her husband with it yet because she knew everything was going to be all right.
And that certainly is possible. That certainly is possible that that's the case. Her soul is still troubled in 27, and but I understand what you're saying. But she knows her husband can't do anything about it,
right.
And she knows Gehazi can't really do anything about it, which she proved right on that as well. And that Elisha is a person to go to. Now, I did not. I have to acknowledge I got in late yesterday. My flight was delayed for like 5 hours, and I didn't have all my resources, and I didn't get to look at this. But I have looked at it in the past. I always like to review these little notes that I don't know off the top of my head. But Jesus raised a boy at Nain and gave him back to his mother, the Bible says.
Nain is close to Shunem. Remember when Jesus raises that widow's son in Luke 7, the statement is, a great prophet has arisen among us. Why would they say a prophet? They say a prophet because it's like Elisha. And he's done this deed in this area. But God, this is also a rebuke of Baal worship. It's a rebuke of Baal worship because Baal can't provide a son. And Baal was believed to be a god of fertility. Baal can't raise the dead. Only the Lord can. So that episode, and of course it's paralleled. We've already, well, I thought we had, but 1 Kings 17, Elijah raised a boy from the dead. 1 Kings 17:17-24. Let's see if we can get through one of these two miracles at the end and then pick up with the other and go through 2 Kings 5 on Wednesday. In verse 38, when Elisha returned to Gilgal, there was a famine in the land. And the sons of the prophets were sitting before him. He said to his servant, put on the large pot and boil stew for the sons of the prophets. Then one went out to the field to gather herbs and found a wild vine and gathered from it a lap full of wild gourds and came and sliced them into the pot of stew, for they did not know what they were. So they poured it out for the men to eat. And it came about as they were eating of the stew that they cried out and said, O man of God, there is death in the pot. And they were unable to eat. But he said to them, now bring meal. And he threw it into the pot and said, pour it out for the people that they may eat. And there was no harm in the pot. This may show us the sons of the prophets ate their meals together. Right, that's interesting to at least some of them. And so it's a famine. There's not as much to eat. And they're boiling stew. And one man goes out and gathers some. Maybe he thought he knew what they were. But verse 39, it says he puts them in the pot and they didn't know what they were. Maybe it's the people who are eating. But, you know, this is a good practical lesson. If you don't know what it is you're picking, don't put it in a pot of stew.
It worked out with manna.
Yeah, manna, that's right. Manna, they ate that okay. He said, what is it? But it's a general rule. I think that is a good rule. If God speaks and says, eat it, you can. But anyway, they threw it into the pot and they say, there's death in the pot. Now, does that mean it was poisonous? Or does that mean only that it would have made them very sick? I don't know. And again, here's a place where a lot of commentaries try to identify what this plant was. I just don't think you got to... We can do anything like that with certainty. And he says, bring meal. He throws it into the pot and says, pour it out that the people may eat. And there was no harm in the pot. Now, what does that remind you of that y'all studied recently? Bob, what does that remind you of? You taught it.
Ask the question.
Okay, yeah, about throwing the meal into the pot and there being no death in the pot.
Well, sweet water, so
yes, and also Elisha threw the salt in the water of Jericho. Remember the in
right. That's what
and,
I was referring
to. Okay, yeah, okay. But I was thinking you might have mentioned in Moses. Moses threw his tree in the water, and remember the bitter water became sweet, and then also as Bob taught recently, that you have the 2 Kings 2 and throwing the salt in the water. We'll try to pick up with verse 42, and then we'll try to get Naaman and the leper, which is all one straight, one story. So we'll try to get that together. Thank you. God bless.